welcome to a very special episode of Filmwax Radio, episode number 248. This episode is sponsored by Fandor. And my special guest today is filmmaker, director, producer, actor Larry Fessenden from Beyond the Grave. Anyway, I'm going to try to transition back to the normal voice. If I can, perhaps that would be nice. But perhaps you would prefer this voice. You know, I actually do have ancestors from Transylvania, so they say. I have Hungarian blood. I don't know. I'm not positive it's true, but I'd like to think so. Welcome to, episode number 248 of the show. So I played a shorter version of this conversation for Fandor, for Keyframe, in a more abbreviated version. We discussed Larry's career and, of course, his films that he's made that are either on Fandor or, in general, his commitment to the horror genre. And now, though, for my ardent listeners, you get to hear the whole conversation, which is about an hour long. And it's a lot of fun. And we get into nitty-gritty. So I've known about Larry for a number of years, and ever since I've put my eyes on him and then watched him in any number of films, including Habit, Wendigo. I saw him act in any number of films with under the direction of Kelly Reichardt, and then I saw him in a couple of Swanberg films. But it was right around the time that I saw Larry in Joe Swanberg's movie All the Light in the Sky, and anybody who listens to this podcast regularly knows that I'm a fan of that particular movie. But it wasn't then that I saw Larry acting in a non-genre film. Okay, so it was sort of more realistic, I guess you could say. Anyway, he was so good in that movie. Watch it if you can. Again, you can always just get if you don't already subscribe to Fandor, you can get a 2-week trial subscription and do that and check out that film. But I also talk about other films on Fandor. They got this month leading up to Halloween. They have just a month of horror films that they're promoting and emphasizing. And I watched a few of them, and I recommend them on that program. So this is a conversation I finally had with Larry. Now, I went down to Dumbo, to the Glass Eye Picks production office where Larry's company is, and met him for really the first time in person. I have a number of friends, many of whom have already appeared on this show, who know him quite well and told me what a great guy he is. And so that turns out to be quite true. Not only was he just a sweet, nice, funny guy, but he gave me a ton of time without looking at the clock. I think I wound it down, in fact, at the end, because I just thought, you know, let me give him his, let me respect his time. Funny enough, after just meeting him for the first time then, I went up to Woodstock, where I know he has a home. And but I went up to the Woodstock Film Festival the other day, and sure enough, I ran into him. His son has a short film in a block of shorts, children filmmaking. His son was one of the filmmakers, so Larry was there, and we had a chance to say hello. But I should mention we talk about that very much so in this conversation about his son, and about his son carrying on the mantle of filmmaking now. So there you have it. And what else can I say about it? It's just a great conversation. It's all a little bit all over the map, but we do talk about his Larry's career going way back, and also about the industry and his feelings about that. So it's one of my favorite conversations in a while, and I hope you enjoy it too. My conversation with Larry Fessenden, and we'll be back after that. It's so great to meet you.
Yeah.
You know, what happens is I've seen you in a bunch of stuff and like a Q&A's or whatever. But the thing is, sometimes there's like one thing, one performance or one thing, and it just sticks with me.
Oh, cool.
And for me, with you, that one was in All the Light in the Sky, that Swanberg film. And
I saw it at the Northside Festival in Brooklyn. I think it was last spring, 2013. They showed it. It was such a nice surprise in general, and Jane Addams was like so great in that. Oh my gosh! And then your performance was really just whatever reason the performance touched me very much. So that was it. That's the story. I can leave now.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Yeah. It's funny because when I first worked with Joe on a movie called Silver Bullets, which my part got cut way down, but I did work with Jane, and I think that's why he thought I got to get these guys together in something else.
He saw something there.
Is that well, what it was, yeah, presumably. I'm usually resistant to the idea that we're going to just go in and do an improv, you know. Yeah. But it's interesting. Joe seems to have an approach that puts you at ease, and he really draws on what you have to offer, and so you don't feel on the spot like I'm supposed to come up with lines. So I think it's really a tribute to his approach that that he gets interesting performances from, also from non-actors, which is to say the environmentalist in that, the solar guy, is just someone's uncle,
right? Yeah.
And there's such a tenderness to that film. I really agree, and I appreciate you citing it, because of course Joe's movies are not always distributed traditionally, so that movie could fall between the cracks, but I was fond of it. And I rarely get to play myself or a so-called real person. I'm usually in a horror environment where there's a bit more broad strokes being called upon. So
perhaps one could also argue maybe, Kate, you bring some humanity to those roles at times. I suppose
I'll take
contextually.
That. Yeah.
And I also think, and you said about Joe Swanberg, you know, he distributes and has to find kind of alternative ways. I mean, that's also the sheer quantity of his output in the last few years has also kind of required that. He was talking about it, like it really kind of almost calls for binge watching, because he has so much stuff that you kind of get to it together in a group of films. Just sort of.
Well, it's funny. I always think of movies as music for some reason, in terms of like albums, and Joe has a lot of these sort of acoustic albums that he puts out, so to speak, which are these little films. They're not all, you know, they're not monolithic 3 years in the making. They're short stories, or the, you know, there's they call to mind other art forms where you can have something that isn't the great work. It's just a little something, and sometimes those become the gems, and that's the beauty of it all.
That's right, and that sort of happened with, I think, All the Light in the Sky, on some level anyway. It's pretty cinematic too, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, his instincts are always cinematic.
Yeah, but thanks for agreeing to sit with me and to do this, and I didn't know you were here, I guess, in this particular location. I was up at Bard a bunch this summer, but it was during the summer, so I didn't really have any expectations that I might run into you. You teach a class, is that what?
No, right? It's funny you think that. Friend Kelly Reichert.
I know she does.
There,
yeah,
and I have been there on occasion to support her class, but honestly,
okay, very good.
No. I don't teach anywhere. I'm working on it.
Okay, professor.
Yeah.
No, I know she does, and I was trying to. I thought maybe what I heard was I created some sort of bastardized version of that story, and so I would happen upon you on the campus there. I went to school there 2 years ago, so I was up there for other reasons, coincidentally, and it was it's just amazing up there now.
It's a great campus, and I do have a house upstate.
You do?
It's on the other side of the river, not quite so Tony, but I love the weather. I love the change of the seasons. This is a great time to be up there, and Bard has a great campus. It's fun to visit,
Speaking of which, you're also a regular at the Woodstock Film Festival, right?
Yeah, I mean, by chance, I usually have something to submit, and sometimes I do a panel, sometimes I'm a judge. I do the nice thing where you talk to the kids on at the school there. So I'm involved. I've known Mayra and Laurent for years, the founders, and it's a great event in that little town. It's fun.
I also talked to her recently because I just thought, oh, you did? Okay. Because I just thought, you know, this is something I want to create. It would be nice to create a little bit more of a relationship with a festival like that. And I was asking her about the proximity and also trying to be a local community-based festival. But at the same time, as I said, because of the proximity to New York and what we're doing here, it's like a lot of people are going there for that. So it's an interesting tightrope that she kind of has to walk in terms of what is this festival? Where is it going to go? are we going to be that over there from New York stuff? That, or are we going to be up here and doing our own thing?
I think it's tough. I think, you know, I think the festival world is very competitive. There's also the Hamptons that sort of nips at our heels. And, you know, everybody needs a premiere now in order to feel like they have the festival to go to. But unless buyers are at a festival, then you don't ever quite tip into that reputation. So,
right.
And I'm sure something gets picked up. Quite honestly, our film American Jesus, which is a documentary outside of the horror genre, that it technically our dealings began at the Woodstock Festival. So we could say a sale was made through the festival, but I don't think that's really what that festival should be about. But I'm sure Mayra feels various pressures to
grow,
you know, compete and to grow.
Sure.
Also, what happens is that there's not a lot of venues in Woodstock proper, so it becomes almost an upstate films kind of event, which is great.
In many ways, it's great,
but I can see her needing to grapple with the realities of it all. It's a wonderful, intimate, fun experience, I'll say that, and I'm lucky that I just live up there, so I can drop in.
I guess, you know, it's funny, because like you say, who knew that, like, living 2 hours away would be considered kind of commuter distance at some point. Like, the world has changed quite a bit. So one of the other things that I mentioned in before we met was that I didn't know you had already been contacted by Fandor for Keyframe, some sort of other article or piece, interview perhaps, because I just said, you know, I sent an email over the weekend saying I think Larry, we're going to sit down and I'll provide. I didn't have any idea that they already had contacted you. But it's fine, because it makes sense. I mean, I realize it's Shocktober, after all.
So. It is Shocktober, yes, when I really come out. Well, we have... it is a fun month, obviously, just in general. I like October.
You do?
I celebrate Halloween. I like to decorate the house and all those fun things. I have a kid, so it's appropriate. Not just me. And then
now you have a reason to extend your childhood.
Oh, absolutely. It wouldn't have mattered, but it's helpful to have he's my beard, you know. So, but we also there's Comic-Con, which is always fun.
Right.
We're doing Comic-Con next week, and it's just great to have a booth and feel you're among like-minded freaky people. I mean, of course, there's a great. Video games and superheroes, but there's also the horror community, it's fun to be among them.
You know, it's funny. I talk to a lot of filmmakers who are doing maybe Jewish subject film or a gay subject film, niche filming. You can make a living at it. I mean, it's sort of. You know, in terms of even low budget, which is where you found your sweet spot, right? Because you can actually have a life. Because of the comic cons and because of the festivals and
I mean, I always say that genre is the star of a genre movie, you know, as opposed to the obligations to get name actors and all the things that start upping a budget. You can still, in concept, make a low budget horror movie and sell it and have it seen and be in the pipeline. Having said that, I find it difficult in the landscape today to have anything be sustainable. It's just, it's a difficult time. Money is tight and the demands are bigger and bigger for, as I say, the notion of having a name actor in a small film has, so there's a lot of pressure and it's difficult to figure out how to distribute movies and to get a, monetize everything. But horror and the Jewish pictures and the gay pictures, that's definitely where you have to start. And I'm making a gay Jewish horror picture, which I'm very excited about.
I'm trying to quickly think of the casting. Are you just always keeping your bags light, in a sense, and because you never know which way the wind will turn or come from in terms of how things are going to look on this tricky landscape?
It is a tricky landscape. And, you know, I've always, my whole mantra, and we've been doing this for a long time, is... find the thing you're passionate about and make that count and make it happen and don't try to anticipate the marketplace. That's just a whole other way of approaching things and it could get you into a world of trouble. I believe very strongly and I think the strongest work we've done is because I've encouraged somebody to follow their muse or I've steadfast, followed my muse, or we've done something unexpected, like the radio plays, which we've done, yeah. Tales from Beyond the Pale. This was not a commercial move.
Right.
And yet we ended up working with so many fun people and really getting kind of an ongoing series. It's a way to be creative. It's a way to meet people and to reinforce relationships. So it has advantages or benefits, but ultimately, it's because Glenn McQuaid and I said, this is what we should do. And I think that's really what I encourage. Also, people should be young, ready to experiment and start out. You know, these are also the people I find the most inspiring to work with, not because I have an age thing. I actually tend to be more curmudgeon-y as a personality, but I just believe get them when they're still hungry and they haven't settled into the realities of how tough it is to be in showbiz.
You grew up in New York?
Yeah.
You're a New York boy? Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in the city, Manhattan? Or?
Yeah, I grew up in Manhattan on the Upper East Side. My parents were fairly straight-laced. I mean, there was always the encouragement of creativity, but they really didn't know what it meant that I wanted to make movies or be an actor. I mean, you know.
Well, how young did you get that bug?
I would say, you know, well, I was drawing and painting and doing those things when I was little. And then just, I guess, by eighth grade. But, you know, I was in the third grade play and I played the dragon in Prometheus. And, you know, it was the smallest role, but I made sure that I had the biggest impact by falling off the stage upside down onto my huge dragon head. And everybody talked about it for weeks. So
yeah.
I feel like I always had an instinct towards the macabre and the theater arts and so on. I was the ham in the class and making trouble.
You say you were kind of drawing, and I mean, it sounds though maybe you were very kind of on some level an internalized person like that. I know I was as a kid; I was inside my head a lot.
Yeah,
I don't know if that can also create quite a rich fantasy life of sorts.
I had a rich fantasy life. I always laugh that I had a German nanny for a period, Miss Sieg. She was lovely, and she would take me to a German church. And I just remember I'd sit there for literally an hour and a half and they'd be prattling on in German. I mean, these are some of my most fertile moments.
And it was all in black and white.
Yeah, it was in black and white. And the scratches. Anyway, I also grew up in the 70s. You'd watch movies on TV. It was a very precious thing because you didn't have VHS or DVD or streaming or anything like that. So you really had to comb the newspapers to see when your favorite scary movie would be on, Curse of the Faceless Man or the next... you know, Ghost of Frankenstein, not the House of Frankenstein. And so, you know, you had to work hard to nurture your fantasy life.
Yeah,
and then you'd have the magazines like Famous Monsters of Filmland and all the film. Everything was much more precious and spare. And I think that actually nurtured one's creativity. And at least people of my generation know what I'm referring to. We had Aurora monsters, you know, the little monster models, and there was only 12 of them or something.
You had time to savor it, the whole experience, and you had to postpone gratification a lot more, so you savored the whole experience and really, yeah, I agree with you. I was, I think we're the same age, actually, and grew up at the same time, not too far away.
I hold it very dear, and I know that that savoring led to a sense of appreciation, and I'm reading a book now, not to get too droll, but it's called The Impulse Society, and I highly recommend it. It's really an interesting, it's sort of a continuation of the concepts in The Culture of Narcissism by Christopher Latch from the 70s. And it just speaks of having instant gratification has really changed society, and it's fun to track that. I mean, there's a lot of books about, you know, economics and various ways to the environmental degradation, the different things that have gone on since the 80s. But this one is appealing because it's kind of an umbrella, and it's about how just our technology has changed our expectations. And it really does speak to someone from the 70s when we had much less access to the things we loved, really.
Well, you know, I know you talk about slow approach. Like maybe even a shot, but also in the storytelling and everything and every aspect of it. And, you know, a fairly successful film back when we were kids would run at a theater for months sometimes. If it was a big hit, it could be there for half a year or more. I mean, come back. They'll bring it back because it was making the money for everybody. So, and now it's just It's just it is true, because like if you can get a theatrical,
right,
you can expect a week if you're lucky, maybe longer, but it's more likely that you get a week. And why are you even doing it? Because you're not making money at it anymore. In a lot of cases,
it's confusing. And you know, I think the reality is you make films because there's a real passion to see images strung together and the impact of a new approach to a story, or just, in other words, it's an art form, and we forget that because there's so much talk of the business now that we almost forget that the impulse to make these films comes from, hopefully, some desire to say something, to see something in a new way, and to use this medium. It's very specific. It's not writing per se, and it's not painting. It's not music, which can be very visceral, mm-hmm, and immediate. It's this time-based medium, and I think I feel the way we even talk about movies is a little disrespectful to its potential to really mean something in our lives. And you know, I always love people who don't go to the movies have absolutely no relationship to movies at all, and you realize, wow, I'm really wasting my time.
How old is your you have one child, or?
My son is 14, and it's almost getting to the point where I have to pitch his stuff because he's a filmmaker now, which came about unexpectedly, but maybe it's incredibly obvious. Well, it is funny. I think most dads would go out and play a ball with their kid, but we would always just go out with a camera and sort of say, you know, okay, you know, you're running over here and the bad guys are coming. And so now he takes it very seriously, and he's made a couple of shorts. Mm-hmm. Two of them have been in the Woodstock Film Festival.
Like when he was 12 or something? Like
his first one, as I say, we made little films together since he was a kid. But he made a movie 2 years ago, so when he was 12, and that's great. It's a zombie movie. And then he sat me down and he said, Dad, I'm not gonna just stick with horror. I hope that's okay. These are all the inverse of most parental conversations.
I'm sorry. It's like a letdown for Dad when your kid's not making bloody gory.
I'm sorry, Dad. I'm going to do something a little more serious.
So he's always, I see. Hopefully you'll respect him. Like, not pretentious or something.
We'll see, exactly.
Yeah. So I might be flopping back and forth a little bit in time, but so what happened since the German religious education, as you described it, and maybe 15 years later, creating Glass Eye Picks. Yeah. So you went to prep schools. I'm sure you didn't have any choice, right? And did your parents?
No, it's interesting because I don't have any intention of sending my kid to prep school unless he wanted to.
Yeah.
It's obviously a huge expense, but more importantly, that doesn't feel like where we are. But when I was young, I had two brothers. They both went to prep school, and it seemed like the exact thing to do to get away from the folks. Mm-hmm. And so I went to a really good school, and I was there for 3.5 years before getting kicked out. And that's where I did a lot of theater, and I really... Mm-hmm. But like with so many things, I drifted from acting to directing and putting on the whole, let's put on a show. And it was very much like the Wes Anderson movie, where I would put on plays of movies that I liked. I put on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I wrote myself, and it was a huge production.
Which started as a play.
It was a play, and then of course it was a book, then a play, then a movie, and then it was my play, which was its final iteration, and surely the best.
In this one, Chief is actually decapitated, and I don't know.
The funny thing is, of course, I'm associated with horror, but always I've been trying to move horror in the direction of the other kinds of movies that I loved, like Cuckoo's Nest and Taxi Driver, and the movies of the 70s. And to try to bring this kind of gritty realism and sort of in a way pose the question, what if this stuff was real? What if there really was a vampire in your everyday life? And I feel that's always been... So maybe to answer your question, I got through this prep school until I was kicked out, and then I knew that I wanted to go to NYU because in those days, early 80s, the only place you could make movies was either in California schools, which seemed too far away for an Easterner, or NYU. So I got in there with a GED exam.
Really?
So I
barely scraped in or whatever.
Yeah, honestly, wow. I think if you can pay, they'll take you. But I showed tremendous enthusiasm. I'd already made some Super 8 movies. What happened is in 1979, my mind just sort of snapped, and I realized that where the camera is mm-hmm. is what tells the story. And this suddenly opened my mind to the power of filmmaking.
Like, what do you mean, I guess?
Well, how you tell the story, and I'll use my favorite example, of course, is Hitchcock, and he yeah. speaks well of it in his book, Hitchcock Truffaut, where he's interviewed by Francois Truffaut, and it's really about, you know, and it's also about pacing. Mm-hmm. All the choices you make when you make a film are beyond even the story, but how you elucidate the story. Do you use a single take? Do you use close-ups? Are you wide, which suggests an indifference? It suggests the world existing, you know, from a distance. Close-ups, you're presumably more subjectively involved. So all these choices, it became very clear to me as I started thinking about all the movies I loved. Like, I almost, in a single wash of time, realized how powerful that is and what an exciting medium it is. So I started making Super 8 movies. These mm-hmm. were silent films and whatever. And then when I got to NYU finally, they had a video department, and I was like, oh my God, I can make sync sound films for nothing. And then I started getting into making.
Because before that, you mean like you had, the camera that you had was not, it didn't have an audio, so you'd have to carry a separate recorder for audio and then sync the two.
Yeah, in the case of Super 8, that yeah. was the thing. Or right. And then, yeah, it was just very cumbersome to get into sound. And in a way, once, as with so many things, that was my training, so mm-hmm. you could argue, well, I worked visually for a long time, but then the idea that you could get a video camera and record sync sound was mm-hmm. very exciting, and that's then I had a TV show on public access where we had to present a tape every week, and that was a great training. That's basically how I learned to edit, because my friend never wrote the scripts properly, so we'd just have this material that we'd shoot, uh-huh. and then I'd have to cut it together, and then I made a version of Habit, the film that I had eventually remade, but I worked on that for a while.
The short first, you know.
Yeah. Actually, it wasn't. It's a very tedious film. I don't think it works at all, but it was like 90 minutes, perhaps.
Oh, really? The first version.
Little or nothing happens, and I finally cut it down to 20 minutes, and that's sort of presentable. Anyway, this is all to say that it was always sort of a do-it-yourselfer, kind of trying to find my way. I like to point out that there were no film festivals when I was growing up. There was no mm-hmm. mechanism that was clear to me as to how to become a filmmaker. It seemed like this very distant thing that was being done by Scorsese and Spielberg, but of course the people before them even more so. Mm-hmm. And then the horror movies were like The Omen, so that was Hollywood's domain, and mm-hmm. it was The Godfather. These were the movies that were being made, but there was no sense that you had any commonality with those people. So nowadays, the kid grows up and they want to make movies, and there's a real path. There's an advisable way to do it, make a good film, try to submit to a festival, but right. we didn't have that. So right. I was making stuff and taking it to the video store yeah. and saying, will you rent this?
Yeah.
So I made a huge epic film called Experience Movers, and I took it over to
Experience
Movers.
Uh-huh.
And I took it to New Video, which was on University, uh-huh. and uh-huh. they put it in their catalog, and you could rent it, and I was the most thrilling thing in the world.
You had distribution.
I had distribution, and I made the cover myself, and I sort of followed that model stubbornly almost to the present day. I mean, I still think of people say, when did you enter the business? And I said, well, I haven't quite yet. You know?
Well, you created your own enterprise, your own.
Yeah, and I try to, the reason I've served as sort of mentor figures, I just try to get other kids to realize, listen, you know, do it yourself, do a good job, and you'll become an asset, you'll become a value, and they'll absorb you into the system if you play by their rules and you know, do the right thing. But it's a fine line. I still believe in individual voices in the arts, and that I believe in the auteur theory, and that there's a specific voice that you want to put out, and that's going to ultimately be more valuable than trying to conform and to anticipate what others want, because mm-hmm. honestly, they don't know what they want. They didn't know they wanted Blair Witch until it was made, you know.
Right.
So that's sort of the mantra.
Yeah. When you were mentioning other filmmakers too, I was thinking originally when you said where you put your camera, I was thinking Pal Pressburger, and I didn't know if you were impressed by those at all, or De Palma comes up too, I guess. I didn't know if that.
Oh, De Palma was a great stylist. Now, even like, as a kid, I felt he was ripping off Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Which is either true or not. I think De Palma would say,
at least,
give me a break. This is my own style. But, you know, he would often pay homage to various things, be it, you know, Battle Potemkin in Untouchables or various Hitchcock tropes. Mm-hmm. But all of those filmmakers were intriguing. I mean, I would say the ones that I most responded to were Scorsese, because of his incredibly visceral camera work and just his utter engagement with his characters. I loved Marty's movies. I still do. I think he's a hero. And then, you know, I really was inspired by Polanski, who has a very different approach, not quite as showy. In fact, he only uses a few lenses, but just his storytelling and the sort of the realism, once again, the subtle realism that he brings to his early films were sort of in the horror genre. I love that. And then, you know,
He also was finding humor there too, so I see the connection because they were done somewhat with tongue-in-cheek, going back to the Tenant, and then he did a Curse of the... Didn't he also have a vampire?
Oh, the vampire killer.
Fearless
vampire killers. Well, The Tenant is absolutely one of my favorite movies. But it's not snarky humor. It's the humor of just fragility and self-betrayal. I mean, there's a point at which he finds vomit in front of all the doors except his own. Somebody in the apartment building has clearly been screwing with him. Well, he realizes that would implicate him. So there's this scene where he takes the little bit of vomit and he puts it in front of his own door, and you just realize this guy is so broken. So I loved Polanski. All roads lead for me back to Hitchcock, who was an incredibly personal filmmaker and yet sort of commanded the medium in such a impressive way and spoke about it so well that I think it helps you understand how films are made if you read some stuff by Hitchcock. And then later, Jaws was my favorite movie for years. I still cite it. And that's
because
basically
of what you don't see?
Yeah, I mean, but...
I mean, that's the obvious
honestly,
go-to.
Look at that film just from cinematic point of view. It's what I've been speaking of. Like, there's 3-minute scenes that's just a single take. It's so beautiful and effortless and carefully crafted.
Yeah.
You know, you remember him saying, you know, take a look at that picture. Those proportions are correct. Love to prove that, wouldn't you? Get your name into the National Geographic. But look at that scene again, and that's at the end of like a 3.5-minute take where they're going up the hill and they reveal the... So it's the... There's integrity to that filmmaking, and you really love the characters. And yes, you don't see the shark until, but we all know that's because he sort of couldn't show the shark, all of that being interesting.
Right.
But it's a handheld movie that is about a monster, so it was a perfect storm for me when I was a kid. It sort of brought up all the monster movies I loved, but it was character-based, and it's actually gritty. And my favorite thing about the modern world is that I've heard people say it's practically paced like an art film now, which is like, shoot me now. If Jaws is not an entertainment that they would green light today, well, I can see why I'm so at sea.
Yeah, and then I guess your last film, Beneath, was...
Yeah.
Must have been your own.
That came about by chance that somebody pulled out of a drawer a giant fish movie, and I thought... I was actually there pitching my other directors and saying, you know, is there anything Glass Eye can do? This was to Chiller Films, and they brought out this project, and I was so tickled at the idea of having a giant fish. So I agreed to do it, and I had a blast. It was really fun just dealing with this practical effect.
Did you use a lot of digital effects?
No, that's the point. I really had
Have you done it?
Have you 12-foot rubber fish? Have I done it?
So they literally pulled it out of a closet or something like that.
I beg your pardon. No, I made the damn thing.
You
I
did?
Had it made in Hollywood by a great
you
effects
wow.
lab. And, you know, it had a workable jaw. You know, huge sea, giant fins, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it swam around. I had some divers who would pull it and manipulate it. And of every shot, every second you see the fish operating, probably took an hour to orchestrate. And I had some great kid actors out in the boat in the middle of a lake. It was I had a great time with that movie, and it's available.
Yeah, no, it's
a hoot.
People love it. I mean,
no, I don't know that that's true. Actually, it was sort of slammed by the critics today.
I said people. I mean,
but honestly, you know, have a look at that movie. To me, it's a great satire of humanity now, and perhaps. As I say, I'm a bit of a curmudgeon because I just feel like we're all a bit lost and not in it for the long haul and not in it for the community. We're all in it for ourselves. So it's definitely a movie that points that out. And the fish is barely even a villain. That's the other thing. Unlike Jaws, I made a movie where the people are villains.
You're more on the in the fish's camp. You're
a little bit.
You're okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's just doing so what obnoxious. He does. The people are supposed to know better.
Yeah.
And it's unclear if they do. So there again, you know, I really like to use genre tropes because I love to see monsters and people turning into Jekyll and Hyde and vampires and Frankenstein monsters. These are just things I love. I love werewolves and creatures from the depths. But I'm still engaged with, an agenda to say, wake up, people. We're screwing it all up. I think the way society is built and the kinds of conversations we're having in our media and our politics are really corrosive, corrupted, self-involved crap, and uh-huh. it's not sustainable. So that's the sort of the bigger message. That's the real horror trope that I'm playing with. And
do you try to create a bubble to sort of keep that out and keep that sort of off of your radar, or just out of your, I mean, is that what you're doing in your own business, in your own?
No, because on the contrary, I'm fully engaged with this stuff, and I like to engage people. I want to talk about climate change, and mm-hmm. no one does, of course. I want to talk about what we're doing wrong and why we're doing it, and sort of draw attention to, I think, and I say our weaknesses, but they're strengthened by our technologies and by our self-involvement. We've forgotten that there's a natural system under which we are lucky to operate. You know, this may sound religious. I don't believe in a higher being, but I believe that we are only part of a web, and that we need to gain humility again and recognize that in order to survive, quite honestly. But also...
Sure.
For the pleasure of life. I mean, if it's all about ourselves and our own texts and our own little careers, life is drained of meaning, you know? And I think there should be some reverence for something outside of ourselves. So anyway, all of that being my own personal feeling, I'm happy to bring that into every encounter and every meeting, because I think that's more important than my next picture.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
And that's what feeds my sense of horror. Mm-hmm. The sense of horror is almost a world in which it's just a human-centric world that is devoid of texture and the sweetness of life, you know?
So yeah.
That's what I'm always romantic. On about. No. Listen, that's why everyone hates my pictures.
That might be a slight exaggeration. I like them.
Let's just say that very quietly.
Glass Eye Picks in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when you started it?
85.
Excuse me.
I just put the name on something. But
what were you thinking? I mean, as you say, it was maybe the cusp of when Spike Lee and Jim Jarmusch, this wave of these guys were all of a sudden coming out. Mostly guys. There was Susan Seidelman. There were some women there. Alison Anders, Susan Seidelman. It was a little early for Kelly Reichardt. She was probably still kind of.
She was working for Todd Haynes.
Todd Haynes
made his movie, Poison. This was my whole world. This is the East Coast, too, a lot of what you're describing.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I would go to the performance venues, and there would be Buscemi working with...
And you acted in one of his films.
Yeah.
At least one, anyway.
Yeah, and so that was the scene. And actually, I spent the 80s, perhaps misguidedly, working with performance artists and just being a sort of a documentarian. I would edit reels for people, and I just really loved fellow artists, and I was sort of the one guy with the camera. It was kind of weird. But then I'd go to the Quad, and I'd see Do the Right Thing. Oh, no, not that. Spike's first movie. And then I'd see Jarmusch's first movie.
She's got to have it.
Yeah. It's Spike's first.
Okay, so there too.
So... And, you know, I'd have a certain amount of jealousy because these were some of the things I was thinking about, and this was all very accessible, that sort of type of filmmaking. So, yeah, and then I'd hear that that Vachon was having a meeting at Anthology Film Archives, and, you know, maybe that's something to go to and see if you could get in with that crowd. I knew Ted Hope, and Kelly Reichardt's first movie was eventually supported by Good Machine, and that was the... So there's a lot going on, and it felt very vital... On the one hand, I've said, well, there were no film festivals. There was no way to make movies. But what I do want to say is that we also felt, wow, we're part of a wave. You know, there's something happening. Because Buscemi would suddenly be in, was it called Trading Places? And you felt like one of our own had
stepped. You would do like a studio film all of a sudden. Like, right? Is that what you mean? Like you would do a
Trading Places. No, it's just a successful indie. I can't even remember.
Is it Trading Places?
It can't be called that.
That's the one with
because
Eddie
Murphy. That's the Eddie Murphy movie. What is it called? Well, anyway, look up Buscemi. It's got to be one of his first films.
Yeah. Well, he did with Rockwell or Alexander Rockwell or with Tom DeCillo. He was doing like all
those. Well,
that was like in everything. Buscemi was so like in the vortex.
Oh, absolutely.
And not that he's out of it, but I mean, obviously, he's still.
Well, exactly. And then I remember seeing Blood Simple when it just opened at what was called the Waverly. It's now the IFC. And that was like, who are these guys? This is crazy. But once again, you felt like you sort of were part of. And then Evil Dead 2, which was sort of the same camera work as was in Raising Arizona. So all this stuff was making a lot of sense. And a lot of those guys went on to be. You know, indie heroes, so to speak, and some of them, I guess, graduated to the studio system. But in any case, it was a very vital.
So, what was the concept with Glass Eye Picks then?
Well, I think one of my problems is they never had an overall plan. What I wanted to do is just write and direct my own films, and I made a film called No Telling, which unfortunately you mentioned. That was overwhelmed by my sense of indignation about environmentalism and animal rights and a whole bunch of other things that came up to me in the 90s. So there again, I was a little bit already being tainted by my passions for things outside of the horror genre or even movies. Mm-hmm. It was a sense of activism, and I really... I wanted to make my feelings known, but in the vernacular of a horror film. So No Telling was a little bit of a misfire, but it's a cool movie now. Because
were you attempting, I didn't see that one. Well, but are you talking about attempting an environmental horror film?
Absolutely, that's what it is, clearly. And, you know, some people say it's preachy, some people this and that, but actually, if you watch it, it's beautifully put together, back to sort of the Hitchcock thing. And it has a strange quality. It's not entirely successful and didn't get me any friends or favors. But then, in fact, it was a little depressing because I put my all into it, and when that didn't work out, I sort of retreated and ended up finding solace in working for Kelly Reichardt. I went and acted in River of Grass, and then I sort of took over the editing and helped her for a year because she was just, we were just figuring it out. We were editing on a 3/4 video deck, so we were editing in order and all these shenanigans. Anyway, that was very complicated, and but it was a good way for me to sort of heal myself from the disappointment of No Telling. And then in response to Kelly's movie and the boot camp that we created for ourselves, I went and made Habit and just said, I don't need a lot of money. I'm gonna show the world how this is done in a New York setting. So I made Habit, and that was, I think, a much more successful film. Very, very personal, and yet clearly a beloved tribute to the genre, a tribute to New York City. So I had sort of my Scorsese love in there, you know, all these things.
And
so,
there was obviously some message to be interpreted in there, too.
Sure. Well, in its own way, it's still a cautionary tale, you could say, about addiction, but there's a greater addiction in there about just, once again, I think, society's ability to ignore the little habits, the little nicks and tucks that ultimately bring us down. So, you know, whatever, it's a macro and micro has always been my thing. Like, you tell a specific story, but there's a cautionary element there that speaks of our society off kilter. And obviously that became much more clear in my film, The Last Winter. So anyway, I made Habit. It didn't get into any festivals either, so I once again was forced into this.
What year was
that,
though? I forget. Was it
I made it in 94, and then it came out sort of in 97. And I really ended up supporting my own film. I mean, I got into the Chicago Film Festival, which ended up a year later being my savior. But I didn't get into the so-called taste-making festivals like Sundance or South By or whatever else, Cannes or Toronto, of course. Once again, not entirely clear how to get those, you know, how to navigate those waters. But anyway, the Chicago Festival, a year later, the guy who ran a place called Facets called me and said, I saw that cool movie. What's going on with it? And I said, absolutely nothing. And he said, well, do you want to open it here in Chicago? So this was a beautiful opportunity. And that's Charles Coleman at Facets. He's still there.
Yeah,
and
I can't wait to go there. I know that theater. I mean, I've never gone to it, but the guy there seems to have quite a very specific vision for
definitely
and taste.
you know, in those days, his operation, he could get Roger Ebert to come in, and I got some great reviews out of Chicago, and it really set this whole course for me to self-distribute, hardly. Yeah. But something that I would revisit over and over as the years went on, like even Ty West's first film, The Roost, we did sell that to Showtime, and that was fine, but I still put it out in theaters following this model that I started with Habit, which is the feeling that you have to self-respect your own work if it's worth it. You should get reviews and be taken seriously, and it's not just get it into whatever portal will pay the money back. It's also give the movie its dignity. So anyway, that was what I did with Habit. Then there was a dry spell. I actually went to Hollywood and did some meetings, but I had a movie that wasn't horror. See, I've never had a strategy. This has been my problem. And when I realized they were all confused by that, I retreated and I wrote a very quick, once again, very visceral script called Wendigo. And then I figured out how to make that with a friend here in town who was able to finance this film at about $350,000. And we got Patricia Clarkson and some other wonderful actors. And then that was that had its own life. None of these were breakout films. I was never really making a lot of money for anyone. And that's why you never get the call from Hollywood. You know, they really want something that's kind of a moneymaker. In a funny way, I've always believed in sustainable film career because I think it's more realistic to aspire to make one good film, make another film, you get a little money, you know, you get an established name and you carry on that way. And that's sort of what I've tried to do with Glass Eye Picks, is not pitch that I've got the next, you know, Insidious or
Saw.
Whatever. Of course, you know, one would always like that, but I'm not...
Right. But that's not the plan. I understand if it happens, it's because you're
sticking to... Sort of like the working man's pictures, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, you got your plan is to stick to, as you said, your what drives you and what you know you love and what the things you know.
Yeah.
And then if that takes and if people respond to it, that's wonderful. That's a of course. It's not the
And just to build a sense of community where people can come and trust that you're. Main agenda is to see them express their ideas the best possible way. And that's where a curatorship comes in, because I can't just have anybody come in who I don't even share their ideas. So I consider myself a curator. The people I've worked with, like Kelly Reichert or Ty West or Jim Mickle, these are people that I deeply agree with their approach to the genre. And that's where I can help them, because I'm like, you know what, dude, you should just do this in one take right here. Just hold on it. Well, there's no, that's not what every executive's going to suggest, and they could be right for their reasons. But in my shop, we love to drag things out and torture the audience. Mm-hmm. That's part of the idea, that you sort of challenge people to sort of open their eyes again and see things fresh. Because it's not just coming at you in 3-second cuts. It's actually disorienting to slow things down or to take to observe a detail that most movies wouldn't engage with. So that becomes the agenda. That's the curatorship of Glass Eye.
Oh, right. And it kind of speaks to what you were talking about before. We're kind of now in a world where we're used to quick cuts, not only on the screen but back in our lives. We're used to much quicker cuts.
Yeah.
Texting, tweeting.
Yeah.
You know, how it just keeps getting faster and with the less of the nuance in there. How can I dwindle this down to, you know,
and I'm not,
faster than maybe the imagination works?
Exactly.
I don't know.
Or than the appreciation or the savoring. It's like I still cook at home a proper meal, you know, and that's, you know, I'm sure there's every reason to want your fast food or your TV dinner, but I would argue that's not what it's all about. So, you know, there's a matter of taste at a certain point, just talking about savoring things. But I think some of the best art and some of the best movies, they're disorienting because it's not exactly what you imagine. And I think that's what I am having trouble with the current society. It's like, just give me the information. Come on, what's the deal? Right. Come on, give it to me in a couple of quick phrases. And you're like, actually... No, I can't do that. This is going to take a little time. And you know what? There may not be a single pithy response. This is something we just have to... Let's absorb this and let it deepen and ferment. So, anyway, of course, I'm fighting against the tide. But the tide is not going in a good way. That's the thing. That's the reason maybe these voices, these alternative voices, should be heard.
Well, Kelly, you mentioned Kelly a couple of times. She certainly, her last film wasn't was paced slowly, and it also happened to be an environmental horror film in a, on a certain level.
Yeah, and well, listen, we're talking about Night Moves, which I was one of the producers on, and the thing I love about that is it takes 45 minutes to present something that in most thrillers would be the 3 minutes before the credits, you know, which is to say they have to load up this boat with the explosives to create this act of defiance against, you know, in defense of the environment. And then what's also interesting about that movie, so that takes 45 minutes and you just see the details and every little bit in the planning. I find that fascinating. And like in America, I feel we just want the information. But there's another way to present things, and that's to present the experience and the little anxieties that build up throughout that.
Yeah, there's a very long scene in the grain.
Yeah, grain? Yeah, they're buying the actual fertilizer from James LeGros.
James LeGros,
an old pal. He's awesome.
Another guy. Listen, I have a list, which you're on there. You've been on there, so
sweet.
Not saying it's a bucket list, but it's I won't use that term. But no, I'm telling you, James is on there too, James LeGros, because there's somebody who I really think is also just a really fine actor who's, you know, takes on really unique, great roles. And whenever I see him, I'm always very happy to.
Yeah. Also, well, you should get him. He's lovely to talk with. He's very smart and opinionated. I'll hook you up.
Well, if not too smart, I hope, because that would be fine. Yeah, hook me up. No, I mean, these are the people that I love to talk to first, you know, and I hope other people like to hear me talk to them.
They've already tuned out. They haven't even gotten to this part of the interview.
I'll turn on the recorder in a couple of minutes, so we'll get some part of this conversation recorded. But by the way, let me know. I do occasionally longer talks, and this falls into under that category. So let me know if you have to.
I'm fine. I don't know if the audience is still with us, but we'll carry on.
Like, and by the way, we have that. It's, you know, there is a place now for. And you know, Ted Hope's got is running it. But it's like here is a site for a website or a distribution or exhibition, what have you, for films that don't necessarily, you know, meet all this other expected criteria now, where there might be a 40-minute film, or it may be something that doesn't work in a lot of the festivals or on TV broadcast or what have you, that it can be whatever the length it's supposed to be, not whatever length is.
Well, that's interesting, because we were speaking earlier about my kid, and obviously I'm producing for him and mentoring him in whatever way. And
it's called parenting, too.
Yes, it's parenting. I'm actually parenting.
I don't know if you
kid.
Can mentor your own child, but I suppose you can on a professional level.
But, you know, he comes up with these things, and they end up being like 26 minutes, short films that are 26 minutes. And we've been advised by various...
5 minutes to 10 minutes.
Yeah, for the festivals. And I say, no, listen, Jack, you're going to make the movie that's exactly right. There's not going to be a frame too much, because that's about craft and telling your story well. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to conform to something. You're only 14. Why don't you enjoy the medium and not start...
For God's sake.
I mean, for heaven's sakes, exactly. So
double that and then start thinking about that. You know, you got to go through...
I think so. Just the creative experience and see what happens.
Because all the young filmmakers you hear, I talk to a lot of them, I guess, and I they're all about, no, I shouldn't say that, but you do hear back about making that first festival, like, you know, this is the festival length, and this is it's a shame.
I mean, it's a shame.
But I understand why they have to do it.
Aspiring to make a 10-minute movie, obviously. Right. But there's just this feeling... When I was younger, we discussed, it was all very mysterious. And now I do think there are certain guidelines as to how to build a career. And although that makes some sense, one doesn't want the art to sort of fall to the wayside. You know, I would say, I always used to say to the kids, you know, they'd say, how do you do this? How do you break in? How do you do that? I'm like, well, first of all, what do you... want to say with this medium? I mean, it's a very potent medium, and I hope you're going to do more than just make a horror film for horror's sake. That's another thing, is people think, well, you always want to break in with horror because you don't need the stars, right? The genre's the horror. You said that, Pheasant, didn't it? And I'm like, yeah, but...
And they're all cheap, and they're cheap because they all take place in a cabin.
In the cabin and the whole damn thing. So yeah. It's all true and fair enough. But the bottom line is, what are you going to say about this cabin that we haven't already heard? That's the question I want them to be asking.
Also, I was curious about I guess you already said Beyond the Pale.
Tales from Beyond the Pale.
Tales of Beyond the Pale. Ewan and Glenn McQuaid, right?
Yep.
You started this idea, which appeals to me, of course, because of this thing I do.
That's right.
I do like that. And I've listened to a bunch, and the casts are always nice and eclectic. And, you know, I love that idea.
Well, there is too, a great
all these
one.
Great indie actors and whatnot.
Yeah, we've talked about Joe Swanberg as a director, but he's actually a great actor as well.
Yeah.
He's in Is This Seat Taken? By Sarah Langan, who's actually a novelist and not a filmmaker. The way the project began is Glenn and I were with my kid in the back of the car.
Well, it's
driving
like half
upstate.
An audiobook, isn't it? It's like half audiobook, or what we call audiobooks.
Exactly. Well, that's
and half
what,
radio plays from the. I mean, that's really what it is, essentially.
That's the thing. But, we were driving upstate, and we were listening to an old radio play because the kid was in the back, and it seemed fun, and some Boris Karloff presents sort of thing. And we just laughed and said, oh my God, Glass Eye should do this, because it had all the right atmospherics that Glenn and I like. In particular, Glenn likes a different flavor of horror than what we've been talking about. He really likes the crusty, old-school grave robber, sort of with a lot of mist, and sort of that other side of horror that I also enjoy. Of course, it's more nostalgic for me than in-the-face punishing like so many of my pictures. But so we share this aesthetic of old-time storytelling, and we just said, well, what would it be like? So we realized that there's so many filmmakers we could call and say, do you have anything in a drawer that you want to pull out, make a half-hour audio play? And our agenda was not to just be old-timey about it, but in fact to really push the audio effects so that you're immersed in a world, which could be anything at a budget. You know, you could be on a spaceship, on a trawler, on an old boat. You could be down at the beach digging for gold. You could be running from aliens. So it suddenly became a very exciting project. And we were able to call up some of our... I had met Vincent D'Onofrio for some reason, and I invited him to do one, and he was delighted because it's a short time commitment. Right. And, you know, a lot of actors have done this in some form or other, and they were happy to come in.
Usually they're playing a fish or a, you know, a cuddly like or a toy or you know.
Exactly. I'm tired of playing fishes. So it's just a series that caught on, and then we had some success with it because people were quite delighted. And then we did a live series, a series of eight of them live a couple
Octobers
ago at Dixon Place, which is
also
brings me full circle because I used to play with my band and see all my performance friends at Dixon Place in the old
back. When you go down the steps back up and you're in this kind of like what was like a bathhouse or something.
Yeah.
Looks like, you know, it's like a big open room with the, right? Is that where you did them?
So that was a perfect spot and we had very atmospheric evenings with all kinds of crazy types. Mark Margolis joined us and D'Onofrio and Sean Young was in. So those were fun. We're still doing them. We're doing some live ones in L.A. around Halloween. And then what I look forward to the most is getting back in the studio because you can really control the atmosphere. And I think what becomes most exciting is to listen to something and you start to actually picture it. In fact, the ones I do, I very often play up that element where I'm really sort of teasing the listener to picture the scene. Like I'll say, look across the street, isn't he look strange? And you know, you just sort of play from there and see how much you can convey just with sound. It's a thrilling exercise.
And does it inform your filmmaking too?
Let's just say that all the Glass Eye movies have always emphasized sound. That's one of my aesthetics from my own films. And then when I started working with my new crop of guys like Graham Resnick and Ty West, and they were also huge sound guys, especially we've talked about pacing. And if you're going to slow down the pacing in the edits, you know what you do? You actually tweak up the sound and you keep the viewer engaged and they don't quite know why. It's actually an approach. And I would say you'd find it in common in all our films. This
are you
really,
talking about
really
the
rich
actual
audio.
Volume? Is that what you
mean,
or are you talking about
the
speed
events.
Of
there's the oh. Let's just say that you've slowed down
dialogue.
The film and the dialogue is missing, but you have maybe a tone or like the little creaking door that's just a little nagging, and even though you're looking at an image that persists, you feel there's something else going on. And what I always like to say about sound is it's you can't notice it. In fact, you can't even judge it. You can't even blog about it because it's something, it's hitting you on a more subliminal place. So I think if you watched House of the Devil, even a movie like Beneath, where you're clearly watching a giant fish, but there's also stuff going on subliminally
beneath.
that's exciting. There's something going on beneath, if I could use the term. So we were always open to do audio plays. Just turn the picture off altogether.
Those are available on iTunes, I guess, right?
iTunes and Amazon. And they're beautiful. The other thing that we've
and
always...
the graphics are just
graphics.
Outstanding.
Gary Pullen is a great illustrator, and we asked him to do all the posters of the first season and to design these box sets. So they're really fun. If you have any collectors in the audience, please buy the physical product because they're just gorgeous and lovingly presented.
I think that people that listen to this might be...
We're coming out on there. Vinyl, just to push the...
Analog.
The analog to the logical extension. And
yeah, that is logical.
The packaging is beautiful, as usual, so...
And that's they can find it through Glass Eye Picks, obviously, right?
Yeah, in fact, they're almost going to be available. They're coming out December 2nd, those vinyls. And you can find all our news on glasseyepicks.com with all the stuff that's going on. For an environmentalist, I'm hell-bent on creating more and more crap.
More crap.
More crap for your shelves. More stuff to recycle.
Fire-retardant crap.
Exactly.
Is there anything that's left that you have haven't done yet or that you'd like to try to amass? Oops, sorry. Guess you saw that coming.
Yeah. You know what? Listen, I got into this business just to make films of my own.
Yeah.
And I have a couple films that I'm very passionate about making, and I'm looking for money and looking for ways to tell those stories as best I can. So in terms of those aspirations, they remain, and that's just traditional filmmaking. Now, as far as format, which is also intriguing to me, there's the idea of long format like TV and what that would do, episodic.
Right.
There are ways to work with even the Tales from Beyond the Pale that we're talking about that sort of pushes sort of a wraparound story in a certain direction. So there's actually lots of cool stuff. I've always wanted to have an app, a Glass Eye app, that you could sort of interact with. So even though I'm speaking a lot of the time about being old school, I really love all the potential for new media, transmedia, all these phrases are tossed around.
Yeah.
And
you,
so
you are in Dumbo.
Yeah, this is Dumbo. They're going to kick us out if we don't come up with some, you know.
Makers of transmedia.
Okay, yeah, transmedia. It's transmedia. It's all the way.
Yeah.
And I worked with Graham Resnick on a video game, which was fascinating. It's called Until Dawn, and it's a big video game coming out on Sony. And that was fun to explore the implications of the format of video games. I don't really play them. Because it's a huge time drain, but I love conceiving of how, you know, you can write them, and that's what Graham and I were doing on that project. So there's just endless.
If there's a way you can slow it down for those gamers,
yeah, exactly. I just want to make sure all my stuff is boring. That's the main agenda.
No, it's not boring. You're slowing them down for it to appreciate.
But listen, you want to know what I really want to do? I want to lay stone. I'm going to be a stonemason as soon as I retire, because that's really what I find most contemplative and the least aggravating. Showbiz is very aggravating, and it's going to be... But I can't quite give it up because, you know, it is like an addiction. You just want to see if you can get this one idea through the gate. So.
So you have a plan, but you have a plan B.
Yeah, I have a plan B.
Okay.
Just backbreaking work.
Well, okay. Do you think we covered it?
Oh, wait a minute. We haven't talked about my band. No.
Oh, right. Actually, that's true. Because I was going to say that maybe dance was the last frontier. Because I remember that you had a band and that you're coming out with a third album.
I am contemplating a design of clothes, but let's see. I keep asking the costume designers, how do you get a clothesline going? Because I got a lot of opinions about the cut of a dress. Anyway,
I don't know if
that's going nowhere.
No, I don't. So I don't understand why. But yeah, well, you do have a band though, right?
And I do.
And I assume you have a third album coming out that there actually might be a vinyl version of it.
Yeah.
Well,
no. You know, the cool thing, vinyl. I'm old enough that our first album was vinyl, and it's actually a beautifully produced album. So
in other words, the whole period of time where vinyl went by the wayside. Yeah. And digital.
That was the middle album.
Was okay.
We're waiting for those 8-track tapes to come back.
Well, they probably will.
I got several products in the boxes.
Yeah.
So that's the deal, man.
All right. Well, we'll get some of the music, and we'll get you know, play it. Maybe we'll play it on the show. We'll also maybe I'll get take some of the clips from Tales Beyond the Pale.
Yes.
And include that too, because
appropriate for radio.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Well, thanks a million, and I don't think we'll ever have to meet again after this one. I mean, as far
well,
as doing
at least
part
not
two,
for 10 more years.
Yeah, there you go.
There'll be something to talk about.
Oh, good. Well, that's more optimistic, I guess. No, it's great to meet you finally and get to know you a little bit. That's great. If there's anybody still listening, this has been a conversation with Larry Fessenden, who is a producer, director, writer, video game entrepreneur, musician, dad, curmudgeon, et cetera, et cetera. No, but thanks a million for giving me all this time. It was very generous.
Thank you. And so fun. That's nice to have a open form chat. And thanks to the few listeners who've made it this far.
Yeah,
you guys are heroes.
You win a prize.
Yes, there will
You've earned it.
A Tales from Beyond the Pale badge. We can have it shipped out to you. Send your address.
And don't forget that return postage, because we can't afford it. Thank you, man. Thank you.
Greetings, audiophiles. I'm glad you've decided to join us on this little journey. I hope you'll take a deep breath now. A deep breath. And just relax and listen with me. Because wherever you think you are, maybe settled in your favorite chair, or slaving away on the computer, maybe you're on the treadmill. Or perhaps you're sitting in a dark theater wondering, did I leave the oven on? Well, look again, listener. For you're no longer where you thought you were. You have crossed over. You are now Beyond the Pale.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in a couple of days with another episode. I'm going to include a conversation in episode 249 that I had with a huge inspiration. If you're listening to this, you'll be the first to know that I have booked talk show legend Dick Cavett, of course, known for decades for being one of the pioneer talk show hosts, and he's talked to everybody, and I'm a nervous wreck because I'm posting the show in a couple of days, but I actually am meeting with him tomorrow. Dick Cavett has a book that is just coming out later this week. It's called Dick Cavett Brief Encounters, and it includes a foreword by Jimmy Fallon, and I'm very excited to have on Dick Cavett, my hero. I mean, of all the talk show hosts, I would say he's up there. I mean, I grab a bit, of course, of inspiration from many different people. I'm sure you can pick up things if you're listening to my show regularly. I mean, there's cadences and there's... I mean, I can't really disguise it. I can't hide it from everybody. Well, not everybody, but quite a few folks. You get my point. Also coming up is a conversation with Volker Schlondorf. Do you know who Volker Schlondorf is? Did you see The Tin Drum? That was his. He directed that movie some 30 years ago, a hero of mine. He turned me on to world cinema single-handedly with that film. He's back, currently playing at the Film Forum, Diplomacy. It's going into its second week, so I'm glad to be able to get this conversation up into the podcast ether so we can help promote the fact. And it's a terrific film. It's called Diplomacy. Again, it was a play, and now it is a movie, and it is a great film. And so we'll have on Volker in just a couple of days with that. I'm also going to play finally a conversation I had with the British filmmaker Rebecca Hogg, who last spring, I think it was, had two of her films distributed here in the States, finally, theatrically. And now her film exhibition is coming out on DVD, thanks to Kino Lorber. And I'm going to air my conversation with Rebecca Hogg, a British director. And also, I have a conversation coming up with Jeremy Workman, who is the son of legendary documentary filmmaker Chuck Workman. And Jeremy, of course, is a successful documentary filmmaker in his own right, except the only reason I bring up his dad is because Chuck has a new film as well about Orson Welles. Jeremy's film is called Magical Universe, and it's going to have its theatrical later this month here in New York. So I had them sit together, and I interviewed them both. So when you listen to the Jeremy Workman part episode, you'll also be hearing his father chime in quite a bit, which is a kind of nice thing to be able to do. And then in a little later on, when Chuck's film comes out, we'll play that part, and then we'll make the entire conversation with the both of them available, too. So it's sort of like him and her and them. It's like the Eleanor Rigby, you know, film. So anyway, that's all coming up in the next few days, and I just wanted to let you know about all that. And if I told you I have tons more coming up, it would be an understatement. When I even just up at the Woodstock Film Festival, I nailed a couple of great interviews, one with somebody who I've really wanted to talk to since I began this podcast, and that is Tom DiCillo, who you may remember from Box of Moonlight and Delirious and, of course, Living in Oblivion. How can anybody forget that film? And so we'll have on Tom in a few weeks or so. I'm trying to time it, you know, with something that might help along, and with his new documentary that's called Down in Shadowland, which I saw at the Woodstock Film Festival. But isn't that exciting? Tom DiCillo. You know, I mean, I've interviewed Hal Hartley. We had on Alexander Rockwell. Now Tom DiCillo. So it's only right, that I should be booking Jim Jarmusch in a matter of time. I also, by the way, have been communicating with Allison Anders, and she has agreed that after sometime early next year, she's going to come on and do the show because she's just so busy right now. And that's nice to hear. So maybe we'll have lots to talk about with Allison. But there's plenty more coming up in the next couple of weeks. So there's going to be another little surge of more content now that A, I've just backed up, and B, I'm home. And there's no festivals going on in the next couple of weeks, at least, so that's good. Okay, man, this is me signing off. Thank you for listening to episode number 248 of FilmWax Radio. My name is Adam Chartoff. This show is presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, be well.
There may come a day when this won't bring you happiness. It'll slip away, just slip away. Tracks, so that when you lose your way, there's no way back, there's no way back, and everything you never learned snatches in your head, all the answers you already know, please tell us what you said, leaves you staring into thin air. Your eyes and make it up, all the dreams that you forgot.